The Haluza Nation. The human beings. The people. See the spiritual in the natural. Through sense and feeling. Everything is related. All the things of earth and in the sky have spirit. Everything is sacred. Confronted by the alien nation, the subjects and the citizens see the material religions through trauma and numb. Nothing is related. All the things of the earth and in the sky have energy to be exploited. Even themselves, mining their spirits into souls sold. Into nothing is sacred, not even their self. The Ally Nation, Alien Nation.
This is Africa World Now Project. I am James Pope. According to the great scholar activist Cedric Robinson, the evolution of the Black radical tradition has occurred while it has not been conscious of itself as a tradition. Its praxis is both lived and intellectualized. One of the most important explorations of Black radicalism was undertaken by Cedric Robinson in his work Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. According to Robin D.G. Kelly on the importance of this work, it has suggested that perhaps more than any other book, Black Marxism shifts the center of radical thought and revolution from Europe to the so-called periphery, to the colonial territories, marginalized colored people of the metropolitan centers of capital, and those France Fanon identified as the wretched of the earth. And it makes a persuasive case that the radical thought and practice which emerged in these sites of colonial and racial capitalist exploitation were produced by cultural logics and epistemologies of the oppressed, as well as the specific racial and cultural formations of domination. Yet for all of Robinson's decentering, he begins his story in Europe. While this might seem odd for a book primarily concerned with African people, it becomes clear very quickly why he must begin there, if only to remove the analytical cataracts from our eyes. This book is, after all, a critique of Western Marxism and its failure to understand the conditions and movements of Black people in Africa and the diaspora. Robinson not only exposes the limits of historical materialism as a way of understanding Black experience, but also reveals that the roots of Western racism took hold in European civilization well before the dawn of capitalism. Thus, several years before the recent explosion in whiteness studies, Robinson proposed the idea that the racialization of the proletariat and the invention of whiteness began within Europe itself, long before Europe's modern encounter with African and New World labor. Such insights gave the Dark Ages a new meaning. Despite all the axiomatic tendency in European historiography to speak of the early modern working class in national terms, English, French, and so forth, Robinson argues that the lower orders usually were comprised of immigrant workers from territories outside the nations in which they worked. These immigrant workers were placed at the bottom of the racial hierarchy. The Slavs and the Irish, for example, were among Europe's first. And what appears before us in the 19th century U.S. history as their struggle to achieve whiteness is merely the tip of an iceberg several centuries old. Robinson not only finds racialism firmly rooted in pre-modern European civilization, but locates the origins of capitalism there as well. Building on the work of the Black radical sociologist Oliver Cromwell Cox, Robinson directly challenges the Marxist idea that capitalism was a revolutionary negation of feudalism. Instead, Robinson explains capitalism emerged within the feudal order and grew in fits and starts, flowering in the cultural soul of the West, most notably in the racialism that has come to characterize European society. Capitalism and racism, in other words, did not break from the old order, but rather evolved from it to produce a modern world system of racial capitalism dependent on slavery, violence, imperialism, and genocide. How do we understand the implications of the tradition in the context of this period of violence and resistance? How do we understand the dialectic of this exploration, yet state and social cultural violence has been a consistent part of the daily lived experience of African peoples? Today, we will explore the Black radical tradition through the eyes of those who are attempting to understand its praxis, paying attention to the relationship between the Black radical tradition, the role of Black internationalism, and the implications of this relationship to human rights. In addition to hearing snippets of conversations I had with Dr. Cornel West, Vijay Prashad, and Ramona Africa, we will hear from activist teachers that are on the ground developing a paradigm that can inform a culture of resistance. After all, according to Amakaw Cabral, the study of the history of national liberation struggles showed that generally these struggles are preceded by an increase in the expression of culture, consolidated progressively into a successful or unsuccessful attempt to affirm the cultural personality of the dominated people as a means of negating the oppressor culture. Whatever may be the conditions of a people's political and social factors in practicing this domination, it is generally within the culture that we find the seed of opposition which leads to the structuring and development of the national liberation movement. This program was produced in solidarity with movements and mobilizations in the African world who are developing their praxis in opposition to the conditions within which they live, such as the Fees Must Fall, Rose Must Fall, Black First, Land First movements in South Africa, Telema movement in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Charlotte, Tulsa, and other points across the African world, as well as Native Americans who are taking a stand at Standing Rock. Enjoy the program. I'm here with Christian Bailey, who is an organizer specifically focusing on Palestinian issues. Could you give us a little bit more about who you are?
Sure. My name is Christian Davis Bailey. I'm a freelance writer and organizer currently based in Detroit. I do a lot of writing and organizing work on Black solidarity with Palestine in a larger attempt to build internationalism within our generation of the Black struggle.
And when you mean by your generation, you mean you're 20-somethings.
I'm 24 next Saturday.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about the importance of Black solidarity, or Black, not just solidarity, but Black substantive organizing around the Palestinian issue. Why is that important?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's important because internationalism has always been a component of the Black radical tradition, which is what we're here to talk about this weekend. And historically, connections between our movement and Palestinians has been going on since the 60s when the Black Panthers and the PLO were training side by side. And so for me, Palestine isn't... I support Palestine and I advocate for it because it's. I mean, if we look at it, it's one of the remaining anti-colonial struggles, one of the largest struggles against racism. And so whereas we used to have South Africa and the decolonized movement in Africa and Asia and Latin America, Palestine's one of the few that remains. And so it's part of our tradition, our historical tradition, to express solidarity with people undergoing a struggle and of that nature.
How does that relate to other people's struggles, say like Afro-Brazilians or even Afro-European? How does that relate?
Sure. Well, Palestine specifically has global implications everywhere. So Israel's one of the largest exporters of drones around the world. Those drones are sent to Brazil to patrol people in favelas. The company that builds the wall between the West Bank and 48 Israel is building the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And so we see all of these systems and corporations reproducing oppression around the world, which is why liberation for Palestinians against Zionism is a central component to liberation for people around the world.
Thank you very much. Just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do.
My name is Renee Hatcher. I am a human rights and community development attorney. Right now I teach at the University of Baltimore's Law School in their community development clinic, but originally born and raised in Gary, Indiana, and still organizing and trying to do work there.
I'm Tanabantu Iverson. I'm an independent labor and human rights educator currently residing and working in Denver, Colorado, and just happy to be here at this conference.
And one of the questions that I've been dealing with specifically in my work as well, trying to critique this whole idea of human rights. We have a human rights lawyer, we have a labor lawyer, these go hand in hand. I'm going to ask a question that is pretty much broad, but you can go about it and deal with it any way you feel. So is the Black radical tradition compatible with the current ideas and practice of human rights? And I'll start with the human rights lawyer first.
Well, I would say absolutely, and it's actually a large part of the work that has been done up through the generations of the Black radical tradition. So there were efforts, right, by Du Bois to submit a complaint to the UN in terms of what was happening to Black folks and other folks in the diaspora, but specifically Black folks in the U.S. So it's actually a history I think we need to reclaim. Now, in terms of I think maybe popular media around human rights work, we don't hear enough about it. But what I will say and what I'm really encouraged by are that people who are of the Black radical tradition who are organizing are using human rights more and more as a framework, right? So there were youth activists that went to Geneva to say Rekia Boyd's name, a young Black woman who was shot down in Chicago, you know, next month, or just this month actually, in Baltimore. Folks are coalescing around a visit by the UN experts on the people of African descent, right, to talk about what has happened systematically in Baltimore to make neighborhoods the way that they are and then also deprive people of basic rights, right? So everything from water shutoffs to horrible housing conditions to not being able to access food, all of these different things, right, can be used in the frame of human rights to further our work.
Professor Iverson?
You ask a very challenging question, and I certainly would echo everything that my sister Renee has said. But I would actually preface everything else I'm going to say by saying it's complicated. I think the Black radical tradition, which is being reaffirmed here this weekend, I think the Black radical tradition definitely is compatible with ideals that that Black people have attempted to advance and defend over the course of our oppression in the United States and within the diaspora and certainly within Africa. At the very same time, I think the foundational ideas and the foundational framing of what we now understand as human rights is not compatible. It is not compatible with the self-determination and the advancement, the liberatory aims and struggles of African people. Why do I say that? Because the very same post-World War II framework that was established based on the experiences and the ideals, basically, of white men who were coming together to ensure that never again would they have to deal with an aberration like Hitlerite fascism. Okay, so yes, they wanted to create a system, but the system was nonetheless capitalist than it ever had ever been. It was still a colonial undertaking, and women were not primarily included, even though Eleanor Roosevelt is one of the names that we often hear of a lot of people who were pioneers. Nonetheless, the condition of women, the condition of children, the condition of gay, lesbian human beings, the conditions of the vast majority of people of color was not really being addressed in the establishment of the post-World War II undertaking. So, yes, human rights and the Black radical tradition are compatible because the struggles of Black people internationally have always been struggles, not just for our civil rights, but for our human rights. But at the same time, we have to understand that the framework, the liberal political framework of human rights is not something that we can simply take a whole and use it.
You want to elaborate?
Right. No, absolutely. So, I would just echo everything Professor Iverson said. And I think what we really can then say is that the Black radical tradition has constantly try to expand what it means to be human.
Yes.
Right? And yeah. So even these institutions, the institutions that we think of when we think of human rights, right? While we may not necessarily want to adopt their particular framework, but we have constantly always pushed in different types of way through advocacy, through struggling, yeah. In terms of what it means to be human. And I think that perhaps there's much more work that can be done even within and, of course, outside of those institutions. Yeah.
So obviously we're talking about human rights. So obviously there's an internationalist component here, right? So how important is a worldview, as an internationalist worldview in struggle, specifically when we talk about Black Lives Matter and when we talk about in Baltimore, how important it is? How can we instill that internationalist view or insert that into the discourse? Do you have any comments or anything on that? I'll start with Professor Iverson.
Well, one thing that I would say is that we need to re-examine the struggles of African people intergenerationally, historically, and we need to once again reaffirm that the systems that have enslaved people of African descent have been systems in which the lives of Black people have not mattered. And so intergenerationally, we have had from time to time to time intermittent struggles to make Black lives matter. Most recently, in 2013, we had three sisters in this country, or not sisters from this country, but three sisters in this country, all Black women, very diverse women, who said, we need to reconnect our struggles in this time, and we need to do it in such a way so that all Black lives, not just heterosexual lives, not just male lives, will be important, and we will be fighting to recreate a liberation struggle in which all Black lives truly matter. Now, let me very quickly say, practically speaking, what that means. One of the things that means is that we have to think about how we can use the internationally established structures that exist now for human rights scrutiny over the activities of various nations, including the United States. In 2014, Renee and I were a part of a number of, we worked with a number of other folks from Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland, putting together a human rights document, which is generally referred to as a shadow report. We did that because the U.S. State Department periodically, every 4 to 6 years, I believe it is, has the obligation, based on its ratification of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, to examine itself and to put itself in the world doc and say, this is how we have been living up to our obligations internationally and domestically. Well, the U.S. State Department typically gives themselves an A- or a B+, where the lives of people of color are concerned. But we came together in 2014 and said, no, we give these folks a D- or an F because of the kinds of human rights violations that Black people continue to experience, not only in Gary, but in Chicago, in Ferguson, in Oakland, in all across this country, in Baltimore. We are still being oppressed on the basis of racial structures and institutionalized structural racism, and that's one of the things that we have to address as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I would just add to that, I think it's a history that folks are reaffirming, and also it's something that younger folks who are just coming into either activism work, right, are more and more aware of, right? So they are making connections between imperialism and racism in the United States. They are making connections between the way in which the military-industrial complex affects Black people across the world, right? They are making connections in terms of the training of Israeli soldiers that are also training with CPD officers, right? So we have a deeper, I think, understanding, and it's I think this conference really is an opportunity to come together, reaffirm that, to politicize those who don't necessarily understand some of those connections, or at least expose them to it, and then to move forward.
So we talk about this history, and I'm going to end on this particular point. We talk about history, and we're talking about labor. You guys are labor lawyers, are labor activists. And I'm thinking back to Eric Williams' Slavery and Capitalism. And we're talking about the history of this, and we're talking about the idea of labor. How important is it to understand? And also with the post-industrial aspect of, is Black labor important, and how can it be organized in a way to kind of move in a direction to develop a internationalist first, but then also to use the mechanisms of human rights to move forward? And we'll start here.
Right.
I know it's a huge question. I'm sorry.
So, you know, you asked, like, is black labor important? Right. To whom? Okay. To whom is it important to? Particularly at this moment where essentially our economy has fallen out, you know, because we are now in a period where the United States will never produce things in the way that they once did. We need to make our labor important to us and figure out ways to organize in ways that will give us an opportunity to reinvest in our own communities and help us build the futures that we want to build. So, of course, I would say that black labor is important and organizing in labor spaces are critically important, but not to this country, not to capitalism. And you read things like Golden Gulag, you understand that essentially the police state that we now live in many of our black communities is connected to a direct effect of the fact that black labor is just superfluous at this point in this country. And so what I would say is we need to think about black labor differently. We need to think about work differently. We need to figure out how we want to organize ourselves internally within the system and how we can begin to build our communities, you know, within this system in a way that actually affirms our humanity and what we want for ourselves and self-determination for black folks in this country. But I think we have to be clear in terms of the system that we are living in.
Amen. I would just say that the system of the neoliberal capitalist system, which basically was established with the destruction of the people's democracy in Chile. Following that, here in the United States, we have seen, as Attorney Hatcher has said, a reorganization of work. We have seen the destruction and beating back of all those kinds of protections that we had for some time, even though they may not have been equally applied to black workers. Work has changed. The labor force has changed. How people survive has changed. But the vast majority of black people in this country are not middle class, but we are continuing to try to eke out our existences with jobs that are not sufficient to help us take care of the needs that we have. So we, as Renee has said, we need to rethink what has happened to black workers. We're not in that period when the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was on the rise in Detroit and struck fear in the heart of capital and its political rulers. We are now in a different kind of historical moment, and we must rethink how we think about work and how we organize ourselves in our workplaces and in our communities so that black lives will truly matter.
I'd like to thank both of you, and one of the things that I'm hearing in this is what Cabral often says is that we're not fighting for ideas, we're fighting for real material realities. Thank you both.
Gambians and Zambians, Ghanaians, my Nigerians, Algerians, Liberians, American Africans, Afro-Americans, Sudanese, Lebanese, and Senegalese, all my Rwandese, Congolese, and Beninese, Bisu, Equatorial, Lenou, Guinea, Libyan, Ivorian, and Tunisian, all my Northern, Eastern, all my South Africans, on my West and my Central Africans, on my Swazi, my Malagasy, my Bukinabi, my Siswati, every one of them is inside me. My angle is my Mozambique, cause I'ma raise my voice so you know I'm speaking. It ain't by choice that I live it, I breathe it, I bleed it, I'm still here. Even when I leave it, assailant, victim, pagan, Christian, labeled a heathen because I follow tradition. Egyptians, Eritreans, my Djiboutians, Cape Verdeans, Chadians, Cameroonians, my Burundians, Rwandese, Togolese, I prep for mine. No matter who I do, I don't appease. My Gabonese, Malawians, and Mauritanians, my Ethiopians, and Libyans, and South Tamanians. My people.
Now get proud. Get proud. Thank you so much.
Listen. All my Haitians, my Jamaicans, I rep for my people like a conversation. I'm Zimbabwean, Malian, my Somalians. We're the key to the new era, and it's gone.
I'm here with Sam Anderson at Black Radical Tradition Conference in Philadelphia, and I wanted to pose a quick question. But before we do, could you give me just a little bit about who you are?
I guess I'm a longtime activist. I go back, my activism goes back to 1964 when I was a student at Lincoln University, at the same time with Tony Montero, as a matter of fact. And eventually became a founding member of the Black Panther Party, one of the early Black Studies directors. I was a math professor before I retired and also taught Black history. Did a lot of work on building the Malcolm X Museum idea in New York and Harlem, working on now Black Left Unity Network. Just been around doing a number of different things in education, doing fighting public education privatization process in New York and across the country.
We had a conversation yesterday.
Also author of a popular book, The Black Holocaust for Beginners, and also did work with an anthology for Mumia several years ago, 20 years ago. So, yeah.
Oh, thank you. That's great. We were talking yesterday, and you were talking about your travels internationally. And one of the things that I wanted to, one of the questions that I wanted to pose to you, and it was a question that I kind of formulated after our talk yesterday. How important is it that people of African descent seriously develop an internationalist worldview of their organizing and of their struggle?
Just like it was said this morning, our tradition, the Black radical tradition, or the tradition of the struggle for freedom of African people has always been global. And it is important that we see and experience our struggle on a global level. And for young activists in the United States, it, at some time in your life, early life, travel outside of the United States to see and experience the world from an entirely different perspective. Oftentimes, you learn a lot more about yourself and about this nation called the United States by living outside, and it's key. I think that as it was stated today, the local struggle is connected to the international struggle through capitalism and hyper-racism, and we have to find ways of in our organizing on a day-to-day basis to find ways of introducing that to, you know, everyday folk. Some people get it right away, but it takes some time for other people to get that. What, because with that understanding, if people realize that they're not fighting by themselves, that their struggle in North Philly is not an isolated struggle, that it's connected, and that the tendrils of imperialism connects all of us, and our struggle for freedom is another, that's a positive tendril that connects us all.
So in this particular struggle, would you say that having an ideological position or developing an ideological position be very a way to do that, to connect those particular struggles?
Yeah, we all have ideological positions. You mean developing a radical, a revolutionary ideology? Absolutely. Because we have to, if we don't have that ideological, we have the capitalists want some variation of that. And that's important for people to realize that everybody has an ideological position. And the question is your position pro-capitalist, anti-black, or is it pro-black, pro-socialist? And so, you know, we have to, or for people who don't understand what the word socialism means, is it for equality and equity? Is it for democratic rights and human rights? Or is it for yourself only?
And you mentioned human rights just now, and this would be my last question, I'll let you go. Do you think that developing the Black radical tradition is comparable to the way that human rights is understood and practiced today from a Western perspective as opposed to from a non-Western perspective?
You mean our human rights, our struggle for human rights in the United States?
Correct.
As Black people?
Yes, correct. As far as the underlining idea under the Black radical tradition is a humanity.
Yes, absolutely. absolutely. The fascinating thing about the issue of human rights is that before we had that phrase, black people, enslaved black people, understood and advocated for their right to be a human being, or their right. They knew, they understood that they had a right as a human to live in freedom. And that was an essential component to how they organized and how they worked through, how they used Christianity to mobilize for freedom during the times of the enslavement times. And then post-enslavement, in terms of the Reconstruction period in the United States, every single civil right was an advocacy by black folk as a human right. And they understood that the human right transcended what the constitutional laws were trying to deal with. And so it expanded from the portrayal of the black Reconstruction to the Jim Crow era. Black people fought against racism and terrorism based on their human rights. And then it's recognized again when the League of Nations was formed. Du Bois, Monroe Trotter, and others, black activists, intellectuals, saw that that was a place to go to advocate for the human rights of black people worldwide. It was the League of Nations, because the League of Nations was talking about world peace and sovereignty and self-democracy of nations and the rights of human beings, etc. There are all these wonderful platitudes, and they were betrayed. And when the United Nations was formed, the groups of black activists in the radical tradition said, this is the place to be, to struggle for our human rights. That's when the phrase came about human rights. That's when the phrase about genocide came about, and black folk understood that we were part of a genocidal movement against us. And they came, the black radical tradition, black radicals, introduced into the United Nations, as mentioned earlier, with Paul Robeson and a host of others, the concept of, we charge genocide on the United States. William Patterson was the other. We charge genocide. And for those who, I believe the book is online now, We Charge Genocide. I believe that's available online. People can look at that up. And another book, very important book, by a sister named Carol Anderson, called Eyes Off the Prize, which is very, very essential. And you can see her online in a video where she sums that up. But human rights is something that after the United Nations thing, Malcolm took up and presented to the grassroots, that it resonated. His way of presenting the human rights issue resonated among the masses of black people in the United States. And it was not until 1967, 2 years after the assassination of Malcolm, that Martin Luther King started to see the same and advocate for the same thing that Malcolm did in 1964 and 65, 63 and 64, about black people's rights as human beings. You know, that he saw that you had to go beyond the confines and the dictates of constitutional civil rights and deal with the international reality of human rights.
I'm James Pope. I'm with Cornell West at the Black Radical Tradition Conference. I wanted to know specifically, is the Black Radical Tradition compatible with the current ideas and practice of human rights discourse?
The human rights discourse has learned so much from the Black Radical Tradition, because the Black Radical Tradition has always said that each human being has a value that needs to be affirmed, that takes the form of being able to live a life of decency. Human rights is about ensuring that people have rights such that they can live a life of decency. So there's no doubt that they go hand in hand.
Thank you very much. I'm here with a very, very important person, but I want her to introduce herself, because I don't think that I would do justice in being able to say what she is, say what she's done, and also, most importantly, what her contributions have been here when we're talking about Black Radical Tradition, to her contributions and also the organization that and the things that she's been doing. So I will give her time to introduce herself.
I am Ramona Africa, Minister of Communication for the MOVE organization. I am the sole adult survivor of the May 1985 police bombing of MOVE. I am a former political prisoner as a result of being the only adult to survive the bombing. I am a member of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Most importantly, I'm a revolutionary. That's what's most important.
And with that, a great segue into the question that I wanted to do. What is the Black Radical Tradition? What does it mean to you?
The Black Radical Tradition means to me, Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner, Gabriel Prosser. That's the Black Radical tradition, resistance. It got lost somewhere along the way. I'm not saying nobody stands up. I love Black Lives Matter. They have stepped up to the plate and they are doing some things, okay? But overall, we've lost it. We have lost it. We've been conned, duped, misled, you know, all of that into thinking that we've progressed, we've made it somewhere in this system. Meanwhile, every day, young Black men, women, Sandra Day, Michael Brown, are getting killed in the streets, in the jail cells. I mean, Eric Garner, I mean, it's crazy. How can anybody think that we have made it, progressed, with these kinds of things going on? And one thing that I am obligated to point out to people is that in May of 1985, this government dropped a bomb on me and my family under the first Black mayor of Philadelphia. My family members, our babies, were literally burned alive. And you know what the overall response of the Black community and some white community members too? We have to support our first Black mayor. How dare you get in my face talking that nonsense? The Black clergy of Philadelphia supported Wilson Boone, spearheaded his re-election, and he was, in fact, re-elected. They had a candlelight vigil for Wilson Boone, not for our babies, our family members that were murdered, for Wilson Boone. You know, the man who, after knowing that our family members were murdered, were dead, said he would do it again. That's the confusion. That is what we have to overcome, that kind of mentality.
Situating this this act within a longer response of the state to radical thought processes and behaviors, how can we understand the importance of connecting what happened to MOVE and also the potentialities of happening today?
Absolutely. That's a great question, because along with what I was saying, the point that needs to be made is that silence is betrayal. And because people of all ilks didn't step up and say, no, we're not having this, we're not tolerating this, we don't care if you say it's MOVE or whoever, we're not having this, people were quiet. Some people were really enraged, but it wasn't demonstrated. And because of that silence, that you know, what's that word? Like when you're all calm about something and you're not upset about it. Because of that, why wouldn't these cops think they can shoot people down in the street, shoot Amadou Diallo, shoot at him 41 times, hit him 19 times, bullets coming up through his feet, meaning that he was prone, he was shot already. I mean, all of the examples we have seen since May of 85. Our point is, when you make an allowance for such things as horrible and sadistic and murderous as the May 13th bombing of my family, you're sending the wrong message. You are sending the wrong message. You are telling these officials that it's okay, they can do whatever they want, and nobody's going to do anything.
And nobody's going to do anything within the context of individuals, but also we have a petty bourgeoisie class of black individuals who allow these things to happen. Because we can link this to the international aspect of bombing children, the drone bombings and things like that. You wanted to...
Afghanistan, Iran, all over. You know, the example that people saw May 13th with MOVE didn't begin and end with MOVE. This is the mentality that this country, the people that run this country, have demonstrated all around the world. And because they do it in foreign lands, it got to the point of, well, why can't we do that here? You know? When you see something as wicked and evil as the way this country goes in another country and bombs them, kills their children, women, people that are not soldiers, not combatants, go way back to the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. When you see those kinds of things, that tells you something about the mentality of the people and the country carrying it out. And we are obligated to speak out against it, demonstrate against it, because that kind of evil, that kind of sickness, it's not going to go away on its own. It's not. The only way it's going to go away is when we make it go away. And that takes work. That takes commitment. You know, consistency. And people are lazy. You know, they don't want to do this work. But, okay, you don't want to do this work, feel like you got enough on your plate, you can't take on anything else. Well, don't cry and moan and go into histrionics when your husband, your wife, your child, your sister, your brother gets killed by the police or becomes a victim of this system. You know, don't cry and complain.
I wanted to pull on, before we end, I wanted to pull on a very, very important aspect. There's a whole talk, a lot of talk about environmentalism and environment. Those who know your organization, know MOVE, know that there was a very, very strong component in understanding land and understanding how to use that within revolutionary change. Could you speak about the importance of that even right now and today?
Okay. Back in the early 70s, MOVE owned two twin Victorian houses next to me. We took sledgehammers and broke up the concrete. We turned the dirt over. We put fruit seeds, eggshells, banana peelings, potato peelings, etc. in the earth, turned it over to fertilize it, to feed the earth that feeds us. People went crazy. They said, oh my God, they're nasty, they're dirty, they're throwing garbage in the backyard. Fast forward, and all of a sudden they put a cute little word called composting on it, and it's the thing to do.
Yeah, at Whole Foods. Whole Foods does it.
Oh, please, don't get me started on Whole Foods. But the point is, there are a number of things that MOVE did in the early days of MOVE. Our first demonstrations were at the zoo and the circus, protesting the enslavement and abuse of animals. They feel that just like Africans felt that, being snatched from Africa and enslaved. The tiger, the lion, the bear, the whale, who is used to having an ocean to travel, you know, stuck in a one of those, what do you call
aquariums.
Them? Aquarium. You know, they feel that just like we feel that, you know. And that was long before animal rights became an issue. We homeschooled our children. People said we were crazy. What are your children going to do? They'll never be able to grow up and take care of themselves. Some of our children who grew up and moved on their own businesses, home renovation businesses, they have those skills. Landscaping, they have those skills. Own their own businesses, you know. Natural childbirth. Move women have their babies naturally at home. We don't pay thousands of dollars going to a hospital to have a baby. What other species goes and spends thousands of dollars and goes to a hospital to have a baby? Name one. Not a one. You know? Now, we're not saying that every woman can do that, because this system has robbed us of a lot of our strength and our health. So some women may have issues and they can't do that. But I'm saying overall, the way it's supposed to be. Raw food. Oh my God, you're gonna make yourself sick. You feeding your children that stuff, you gotta cook their food. They shouldn't be eating raw food like that. You're gonna make them sick. Now they got raw food restaurants from the West Coast to the East Coast. Now, when we were ostracized for eating raw garlic, ew, what's that smell? Who's been eating garlic? Ew. Now, this systems experts call garlic a wonder food. You know? So the things that MOVE was engaged in the early days of MOVE, what John Africa, MOVE's founder, encouraged in us, now all of a sudden, the system is coming our way, has to come our way, because they can't survive the way they were going, you know? But we were crazy.
I wanted to end on it because what a lot of what I hear is original way of living, original African way, African, I wouldn't necessarily say African, the natural way of live. I wanted to thank you very much for taking this time to talk to me, and we'll be in touch very soon.
Without the impact of American and other black communists inside it from the very beginning.
That's right.
You know, it wasn't, and I think this is part of the anti-communist tradition that has grown in intellectual circles, the assumption somehow that communism is a white movement is what they say. But we know that this is not true. Communism from its very beginning was the tradition of the toilers and the oppressed. And they fought to create it in their image. So when you travel, for instance, across the African continent, or when you travel in Asia, or when you travel in South America, when you encounter communism, it doesn't look like the books you read in the United States. They talk about people you've never heard of. But they see them as central characters in their communist journey. So without understanding the black radical tradition and its internationalism, you will be in danger of parochializing it and cutting off one of your own limbs. Mm. This is your heritage. It is not a gift coming to you from the world. When people stood in American streets, in the United States of America streets, to defend Ethiopia against Italian colonialism, they did that here before people in Italy did it as part of their anti-colonial movement. Why were Americans protesting to defend Ethiopia before Italians were saying we are disgusted by our government, because they understood that the fight in Chicago is related to the fight in Addis Ababa. They understood that intuitively. And that, my friends, was in 1936. This is your tradition. This is my tradition. Never let them assume that internationalism is new. Globalism is new. That they are giving us access to the world. Access to the world was ours from the beginning. We never saw ourselves as rooted solely in one place. We always understood that our struggles in one place were linked to a global horizon. Point number two. Point number two is Donald Trump. You see, Donald Trump is not a human being. You need to understand me. I'm not criticizing him. Donald Trump is a synonym for the American ruling class.
Yes, right.
Donald Trump is not unusual. He is merely the sign of morbidity of the American ruling class. Everything he says, they would like to say. Everything he believes, they believe. But they are too careful. They are scared of the public. They are scared for their reputation. He says it, they smile.
We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native American. We have been called hostile. The Halusa Nation. The Halusa Nation. We are the Halusa Nation.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.
My family and the wind, I can feel them. Oh, no, Lord. Sometimes I can close my eyes and reveal them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There is freedom in the sky. Can't help but wonder if you got it already. And I hope the casket don't conceal them. What's in the casket isn't the real them. That's how the universe chose to seal them. Temporarily, momentarily, nature will steal them back to the freedom in the sky. Can't help but wonder if you got it already. Can't help but wonder if you graduated. All the windy that you pass when you read. I heard a monster Musa. My mama and papa told me all of the stories. Nah, 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 nah. Before me, I can feel all of the glory. The glorious allegory. I feel your peace. I feel your peace.
peace. I'm in the peace. I am the peace. I got a peace. I got scars. I got scars. I got a constellation. I got stars. I got stars on my back, on my black. I got space on my back, on my face. That's electricity. I'm in the midst of an epiphany. I got a pistol. I got a pistol faced in a whole bunch in the opposition to my peace. My peace, any better to pray, prepare for an RIP. RIP, all I see is it be the only way.
To the freedom in the sky.